Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Punkahuni Healthcare Reform Webinar. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn today's call over to Ms. Stephanie Pegg. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As you've heard, my name is Stephanie Pegg, and I'm the communications specialist for the firm. I have the pleasure of coordinating today's webinar, and just let me begin by saying how happy we are to have all of you with us here today. Before we get started, I wanted to provide you with some brief background about the firm. I'm happy to say that Punkahuni is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year, and we're very excited about that accomplishment. You may have noticed that in our special centennial logo that we've included a tagline that states, a century of distinctive service. As you can imagine, we are quite proud of our history and our accomplishments, but what really energizes us is are the relationships that we've built over the years with our friends and clients. Today's program, and in fact the entire employer webinar series, flows directly from our focus on service and our added value to all of our relationships. Now, some brief background on the firm. Punkahuni is a firm that is based in Southeast Michigan, and we are one of the Midwest's largest commercial law firms. We have more than 150 attorneys in 9 Michigan cities and 1 each in Columbus, Ohio and Indianapolis, Indiana. Our labor and employment practice group includes more than 20 attorneys who practice primarily in the areas of traditional labor law, human resources consulting, and employment litigation. Many of our attorneys are recognized leaders in these areas of practice. The Informed Employer webinar series is designed to keep human resource professionals, risk managers, and business executives up to date on the ever-changing legal landscape, to provide you with HR best practices, and to discuss trends in workforce management. Today's webinar has been approved for 1.25 general recertification credit hours toward PHR, SPHR, and GPHR recertification through the HR Certification Institute. And please note that a certificate of completion will be emailed to each participant who indicated during the registration process that they needed to obtain HRCI continuing education credits from this program. Participating in today's discussion are 2 attorneys from Punkahuni's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group. We have Laura Dinan and Courtney Nichols. First, we'll start with Laura Dinan. She is an employment law attorney in Punkahuni's Petoskey office here in Michigan. With over 20 years of experience advising employers, Ms. Dinan has built a successful practice with the emphasis on traditional labor and employment law. She provides human resource advice to public and private sector clients on a range of issues, including policy and procedure development, handbook updates, workforce management consulting, dispute resolution, and much more. Ms. Dinan currently serves as vice president of the board of directors of the Northern Michigan Society of Human Resources Directors. Courtney Nichols is a member of the firm's labor and employment law and litigation practice groups. A member of the firm's Bloomfield Hills office, she focuses her litigation practice in the areas of employment law, including discrimination and retaliation claims, whistleblower disputes, premises liability, and civil rights law. Ms. Nichols also represents and advises employers on important employment issues involving various state and federal statutes, including ELCRA, FEMLA, ADA, FLSA, and Title VII. And now for a few housekeeping notes about today's program. If you're attempting to log into our program via webinar, the providerstartvisuals.com, and are having difficulties, please be sure to turn off your pop-up blocker software. And then due to the volume of callers attending today's session and the amount of material to be covered, we have requested that anyone who wishes to ask a question be placed in an operator-assisted question queue. And then at the end of the webinar, our presenters will take these questions as time permits. Our operator will provide you with instructions for entering the question queue during the question and answer portion of the program. The operator will announce your name, the company affiliation, and then open your phone line so that you may ask your question for the benefit of all of our participants. Also note that today's session is being recorded, and both the audio file and presentation slides will be available on Punkahuni's website, which is located at punkahuni.com. Once again, on behalf of the firm, thank you for attending today's webinar. And now I will turn over the program to our featured speaker, Laura Dinan.
Thanks, Stephanie. As most of you already know, the Affordable Care Act is a massive piece of litigation or legislation. Sorry, the rules and regulations are still being determined. The focus we have today is the shared responsibility provisions under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We're going to look at who is a large employer and how you determine that, what the penalties are for noncompliance, and we're going to try to explain the safe harbor provisions to you. The shared responsibility provision becomes effective January 1st, 2014. What that means is that large employers have to offer affordable health care coverage that provides minimum value. If they don't, there are going to be penalties. Employers with 50 or more full-time equivalents must offer minimum essential coverage to all employees who average 30 or more hours in a given month because they are considered full-time under the Act. That should be 130 hours, sorry. While employers don't have to offer health care benefits to part-time employees, you're going to see that part-time employees are used in calculating the threshold to determine if you have 50 workers or more that subject you to the Act. But even if you are considered a large employer based on the calculations using full and part-time employees, and you have to offer health care, you would not have to offer it to the part-time employees. Employers also have to provide coverage to full-time seasonal employees if you're a large employer. And there's a couple exceptions to that that I'll talk about in a minute. An employer who fails to provide coverage, which leads to full-time employees receiving a federal subsidy or a tax credit, will or could result in substantial penalties. This is where the employer shared responsibility payment comes in under the shared responsibility provisions. How those calculations are made, how often, and how penalties will be assessed is the subject of discussion at the Department of Treasury right now, and we haven't seen the regulations on that yet, but they'll get them out, be rest assured. Next slide, please, Steph. Oh, sorry. A large employer is any employer that has 50 or more full-time employees or the equivalent, a combination of full-time and part-time employees that equals at least 50 during the prior calendar year. Under the Affordable Care Act, a large employer includes all employers in the private sector, public sector, and nonprofit employers. That's a little different from some of the other legislation affecting employers, but for purposes of the Affordable Care Act, it doesn't matter what sector you're in, you're covered. Next slide, please. A large employer's full-time equivalents, the employees you use to determine the full-time equivalents have to be employees under traditional common law principles. If they're an independent contractor, a leased employee, and some seasonal employees, they can be excluded from that calculation. As far as seasonal employees, the Affordable Care Act provides that an employer is not a large employer subject to the shared responsibility provisions if the employer averages 50-plus full-time employees for 120 days or less during a calendar year, and the employees who bring the employer over the 50-employee threshold were seasonal workers. So if you do your calculations, count your seasonal employees as well as your part-time employees, you end up over 50, you can subtract. If you are only over 50 for 4 months or less during a calendar year, and I'm going to get into how you do the calendar year calculation, but if you have to actually do all these calculations on a monthly basis, this is a huge burden to your accounting HR department. You're supposed to calculate your employees every single month. You look at the calendar year. If you have 50 employees only in four or fewer months of the year, and those the employees that brought you over the 50 mark for those 4 months, if any of them are seasonal, you can subtract them out. And if you fall below 50, then you are not a large employer, even though if you were using part-time employees, you would be. But if they're seasonal, there is that exception. So if you can subtract out the seasonal, the employer is not subject to the penalties that would apply for failing to provide coverage to full-time employees. In that situation, although you regularly would have to provide seasonal full-time employees with coverage, if you fall below the mark due to subtracting out seasonal workers, you can exclude seasonal workers from your benefit plans if the plan passes non-discrimination testing. I know that's kind of confusing, and if you have questions about that, write them down, and I hopefully could explain it a little more clearly at the end. And something that you should know is that the term seasonal worker under the Affordable Care Act is not limited to agricultural or retail workers. It could be anybody if they just work for a particular season. When you're doing these calculations to determine your full-time equivalent employees, you don't include anybody who works outside of the U.S. So if a foreign company has employees placed in the United States and they have over 50, then the Affordable Care Act applies to that foreign corporation's employees in the U.S. By the same token, if a company in the U.S. has a lot of employees outside of the United States and employees under 50 in the United States, the Affordable Care Act would not apply to them. You only count people who are working in the U.S. Next slide, please, Steph. A full-time employee is defined under the Affordable Care Act as any employee who works an average of 30 hours or more per week in any given month or 130 hours in a calendar month. And an important thing to note there, because I know many of my clients have benefit plans that define part-time as 32 hours, and that is not the standard used under the Affordable Care Act. So benefit plans are going to have to be changed to reflect this 30 hours as full-time, the part-time full-time mark. The IRS is going to use 30 hours as full-time for purposes of determining whether you're a large employer or not. If you have 40 full-time employees that you employ 30 or more hours a week on average and 20 half-time employees that you employ for 15 hours a week on average, that would be the equivalent of 50 full-time employees. And the full-time equivalent calculation includes the aggregation of hours of non-full-time employees to determine the number of full-time equivalents that can contribute to the total number of full-time employees. And, again, I'm going to try to walk you through the calculation in a minute. For purposes of making the determination, companies that are commonly owned will be considered one company for purposes of counting employees. It's based on ownership and control of the companies. If a common owner controls, but companies may have different tax ID numbers, they look at the common ownership. So multiple companies can get you over that large employer mark. Next slide, Steph. The calculations for large employer status are kind of confusing, but it's similar to how you do it for family medical leave, if any of you are subject to that. You take the total of all full-time equivalent employees for each calendar month over the previous calendar year, including your seasonal employees, and you divide the total number of full-time equivalents over the calendar year by 12 months. And then the resulting number reveals whether you have an average of over 50 full-time equivalent employees. If you do, you're a large employer under the Act. So first you do your monthly calculation. You would take your numbers for May, take the number of full-time employees, which is those working at least 130 hours per calendar month. Then you take all the hours worked by all your part-time and seasonal employees, and you divide that number by 120 hours. The figure you get for that is added to the full-time employee number to determine the amount of full-time equivalent employees for the month. So say you have 26 full-time employees. Your part-time and seasonal employees worked a total of 5,640 hours for the month of May. You divide that by 120 hours and you get 47. So you take your 26 full-time employees, your 47 that you arrived at with your part-time and seasonal, and you have 73 full-time equivalents, and you're a large employer. And you have to do that calculation every month. And you're basically going to have a calendar spreadsheet is the way this is supposed to work. And you put in for January, February, March, each month you put in the number of full-time employees employed that month. So you take the number of every one of your employees who worked at least 130 hours that month, put that number in for January, count again in February, again in March, and so on. Then you do the full-time equivalent calculation, adding up the seasonal and part-time hours and doing the math and getting that figure for each month. And then you add those two figures together and get a monthly total for each month of the calendar year. And then you divide it by 12 months to see if you actually come out as a large employer on an annual basis with over 50. And the whole idea of having to do this monthly calculation is going to be a huge burden, especially in the beginning when you don't have your spreadsheets going, and especially if you have a fluctuating workforce. There may be some of you that have a very steady workforce and the number is not going to change significantly, but if you have a lot of part-time or seasonal employees, it's going to be very time-consuming. Stephanie, I think we're on to the next slide, and Courtney's going to pick it up here and start explaining the safe harbor to people.
And picking up from where Laura left off, there is what we refer to and what the IRS refers to as a safe harbor provision. And what this does is allow an employer to use the safe harbor to determine whether ongoing and new employees are full-time employees for the purposes of the pay or play penalty and the purposes of the calculation that Laura just described. As you heard, it's quite a burdensome process. So there is this safe harbor provided to try to alleviate some of that burden, at least temporarily for employers. So there's two aspects to the safe harbor that I'm going to discuss in further detail. One is the calculation for ongoing employees, and the second will be the calculation for new employees. So when we're dealing with ongoing employees, the first thing we need to do is determine the standard measuring period, because an ongoing employee is an employee that's defined as having been employed for one entire standard measurement period. Now, there's a lot of terms that I'm going to be using that are a little bit confusing, so if you have any questions, I would suggest writing them down as Laura did and sort of keeping track, because there's a standard measurement period, an initial measurement period, and a stability period, and they're not interchangeable, so it's important to keep these terms separate in your mind. So what the standard measurement period is a period from anywhere between 3 to 12 months. And this allows employers the option of choosing the period that they want to determine whether an employee is a full-time employee or full-time equivalent. So the purpose is to figure out whether a specific employee has averaged at least 30 hours per week during the standard measurement period, which you'll see referred to as the SMP. So we can go on. As I said, the SMP can be no less than 3 and no more than 12 months. So while you do have some flexibility, it's within that limitation. If an ongoing employee is determined during the standard measurement period to be full-time, then the applicable large employer must treat that employee as full-time during the associated stability period. So we have the standard measurement period, and now we have the stability period. We can go on to the next one. A stability period begins after the standard measurement period. If the employee is determined to be a full-time employee, the stability period must be at least 6 consecutive calendar months. It must be at least as long as the standard measurement period. So if you have a standard measurement period of 3 months, then the stability period has to be at least 6 months. If you have a standard measurement period of 12 months, then the stability period has to be 12 months. So it will range between 6 and 12 months based on what your standard measurement period is. If the employee is not full-time, then the stability period need not be 6 months long. It could be shorter than that, for example, 3 months. But the stability period for the part-time employee cannot be longer than the standard measurement period. Again, the standard measurement period is the baseline in that situation. In the previous situation where it's not a part-time employee, when we're dealing with a full-time employee, the stability period has to be 6 calendar months. That's the baseline. There is one exception to the beginning of a stability period starting after the end of the standard measurement period, and that's during the administrative period. The administrative period is essentially what it sounds like. It's a period of a few weeks or months, not to exceed 90 days, in which an employer calculates an employee's hours, answers questions from employees, collects materials from employees, and enrolls employees who elect into the coverage. So the administrative period, if it's selected, begins immediately following the end of the measurement period and ends immediately before the start of an associated stability period. Again, for ongoing employees, the administrative period can last up to, but not longer than 90 days. And ongoing employees who are covered because of their status as a full-time employee, in that situation, they continue to receive coverage during the administrative period. So there's not a gap in their coverage. The next situation we deal with is the safe harbor for new employees. So, again, these slides that you'll see deal with what I just discussed in more detail as far as the ongoing employee and the importance of the stability period. So if we keep going. So applying this safe harbor to new employees is a little bit more complicated than it is to applying it to ongoing employees, and that's because there's two types of potential new employees. The first is non-variable employees, and the second is variable and seasonal employees. A non-variable employee is an employee for whom it can be determined on that employee's start date that that employee is reasonably expected to work, on average, 30 hours of service or more per week during a month, generally without regard to how long the employee is expected to work. So in that case, when you're hiring somebody and you expect them to work 30 hours per week, the safe harbor method, this calculation that we're describing, does not apply. So in that case, you don't have the safe harbor, and you may be liable for the pay-or-play penalty unless you offer that employee who you expect to work 30 hours per week minimum essential coverage through the eligible employer-sponsored plan before the end of the employee's initial 3 full calendar months of employment. So again, you hire an employee, you expect them to work 30 hours or more per week during a month without regard to how long you're hiring them for. You don't have a safe harbor. You have to make your benefit plan eligible to them before the end of their first 3 calendar months with your company. So there's a 90-day waiting period, but after that you don't have any more safe harbor provisions. available in that case. The second case we're dealing with is the variable or seasoned employee. This is the case with any employee for whom an applicable large employer cannot make a determination on the employee's start date that the employee will be reasonably expected to be employed on average at least 30 hours of service or more a week during the initial measurement period. So this is the third term we have now, which is the initial measurement period, and this is where this term comes into play, is with a new employee that's variable or seasonal. So this is another way to calculate under the safe harbor. The initial measurement period applies to new, variable, seasonal employees. The standard measurement period applies to ongoing employees. So that's an important distinction. The initial measurement period for new, variable, hour, and seasonal employees can, like the standard measurement period, be anywhere from 3 to 12 months and may begin any time between the employee's start date or the date when they were first credited with an hour of service and the first day of the month following the employee's start date. If during the initial measurement period the employee is determined to be full-time, then the employee must be treated as full-time during the corresponding stability period of at least 6 months and no shorter than the IMP. So the stability period for new employees is the same as it is for ongoing employees in the terms of we have a baseline of 6 months if they're full-time or a baseline of what the IMP was if it's more than 6 months. An important aspect of these safe harbors is that employers can utilize different measurement and stability periods for different categories of employees, which sort of seems counterintuitive, but it's true. So, for instance, you have collectively bargained employees and non-collectively bargained employees. You might want to use a standard measurement period or an initial measurement period of 3 months for the collectively bargained and 6 months for the non-collectively bargained. That's acceptable. Same is true for salaried versus hourly. Employees have asked actually different entities and employees located in different states. However, do be careful because you don't want to raise any inference or implication of discrimination. So these are the four categories upon which you can separate your measurement methods. Do not separate on another category because you might be opening yourself up to some discrimination liability. The next thing I'm going to talk about is the obligations of an applicable large employer. So after you go through the process that Laura and I have briefly described, and you've determined, one, that you're a applicable large employer after you've utilized your safe harbors and made all your calculations, now what do you have to do? And this is the key. What do you have to do to avoid that pay or play penalty? Well, you must offer health care coverage to all full-time employees and his or her dependent children. This is interesting because dependents does not include spouses or presumably domestic partners. And dependent also does not include children that are over 26 years old. So it's the same as a lot of health care coverage plans currently, where if you're under 26, you're covered. If you're over 26, you're not. The health care coverage by the employer must meet minimum value, and it also must be affordable. So there's two aspects here, two obligations that an employer has. The first one that we're going to talk about is the minimum value. So minimum value has a general description, which is that a plan does not provide minimum value if the plan's share of the total allowed cost of benefits provided under the plan is less than 60% of such cost. Now that, frankly, is pretty convoluted and doesn't make a lot of sense. So the IRS has issued guidance, and the guidance can be found on the IRS's website, and it's IRS Notice 2012-31. And the HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, has also recently issued final regulations and guidance that provide shape and form to this minimum value rule. So under this guidance, we have been afforded three permissible methods for determining what minimum value actually is. The first is a minimum value calculator, and this you'll probably see and hear referred to as the MV calculator, and it has been established by the Department of Human and Health Services, or HHS. So you can actually go to the HHS's website and use it. It's exactly as it sounds. It's a calculator. And enter your information in the calculator and find out whether you've provided the minimum value. It was released previously. I went to the website this morning to try to provide an updated link, and it was not on the website as of today. I expect that that will be changed shortly. But the website generally is http://cciio.cms.gov/resources/regulations/index.html. If you Google Department of HHS MV calculator, it will also take you to that website. So keep in mind and track that as we get closer to the January 2014 effective date, because that should be updated and provided for large applicable employers' use. The second means of determining whether a plan has provided minimum value is using a benefit plan design checklist. And this is available for plans that provide benefits in four core categories. The first is physician, the second is hospital and emergency, the third is pharmacy and lab, physician, hospital, emergency, and pharmacy and lab. And the benefit plan design checklist applies to plans that have cost-sharing attributes at least as generous as any of the checklist options. So, again, this is going to be a checklist that will be issued by the IRS. We will keep our eyes on this and provide all of you with copies of the checklist through our mass mailings as soon as it's released. This is something that will probably come out on the IRS website that they have posted their Health Care Reform Act guidance on. So, again, something to keep your mind on for these benefit checklists, which will provide a sort of safe harbor because you can actually just follow the checklist and determine whether your plan is providing minimum value. The third is applicable for a plan with non-standard features. So the first two, the minimum value calculator and the benefit design plan design checklist, apply to standard plans. For a non-standard plan, there's actually going to be an actuarial certification like the MV calculator, and you can use that to determine whether your plan provides minimum value. So that is the first of our two-prong analysis here. And the second prong is the plan affordable? Again, this is an area where the rule, as stated, is not very simple, and that is, in order for a plan to be affordable, the employee cannot be required to pay more than 9.5% of his or her household income for self-only coverage. Well, obviously, this is a little troublesome because employers don't know what their employees' household income is. So the proposed rules have provided some various safe harbors for determining affordability, like the ones provided for determining minimum value. The first is a W-2 safe harbor. Under the W-2 safe harbor, a plan is deemed affordable if the employee's share of the employer's lowest cost self-only coverage that provides minimum value for an entire calendar year is less than 9.5% of the employee's W-2 box one wages from the employer for that same calendar year, excluding a period during which the employee is receiving COBRA or other continuation coverage. So, again, this is a way that you can look at your employee's W-2, which you have access to determine whether your plan is affordable. Practically, the benchmark for the employer's lowest cost option for self-only coverage that provides minimum value. So this is the benchmark. The options offered by an applicable large employer must be affordable and provide minimum value in order to avoid the penalty. But you only have to offer one option that is both affordable and provides minimum value. So the lowest cost self-only coverage offered by the employer may not be the benchmark for the affordability standard if it doesn't also provide minimum value. So keep that in mind, that this is constantly a two-prong analysis. So even if you fit the W-2 safe harbor, if you somehow lost your minimum value, then you're going to be exposed to that penalty. The next safe harbor available is the rate of pay safe harbor. Under this safe harbor, coverage, or sorry, I skipped a slide there. We're going to talk about the federal poverty safe harbor. Under the federal poverty line safe harbor, this safe harbor allows an employer to satisfy the affordability requirement for a calendar month if the employee's contribution for the applicable large employer lowest cost option that provides minimum value does not exceed 9.5% of an amount that is 1/12 of the federal poverty line for a single individual for the applicable calendar year. Again, these are not pretty or easy calculations, and I wish they were. It would make my life and yours much simpler, but this is the best we got. So it cannot exceed 9.5% of an amount that is 1/12 of the federal poverty line. Now, an applicable large employer can use the most recently published poverty guidelines as of the first day of that plan year. So if you have a plan that starts in 2013, a plan that starts in 2014, you can use those years' poverty guidelines and determine whether when you divide the federal poverty line for a single individual by 12, if that the plan option that provides minimum value does not exceed 9.5% of that amount. So complicated math. The accounting and HR departments are going to be extremely busy, but like I said, unfortunately, the best we have. The last safe harbor as far as determining affordability is the rate of pay safe harbor. Again, it's not a clean and easy one either. Under the rate of pay safe harbor, coverage is deemed affordable for a month with respect to an employee if the required contributions for the month for the applicable large employer's lowest cost self-only coverage that provides minimum value does not exceed 9.5% of an amount equal to 130 hours multiplied by the employee's hourly rate of pay as of the first day of the coverage period, so generally the first day of the plan year. Doesn't end that there, though. For non-hourly employees, applicable large employers must use monthly salary instead of 130 multiplied by the hourly rate of pay. So this safe harbor may be used only to the extent that the full-time employee's hourly rate of pay or monthly wages is not changed during the calendar year by the applicable large employer or any other large employer to whom the full employee is transferred. So those are some of the safe harbors. The word safe is interesting because it's definitely not a simple harbor. There's no real way for us to break it down at this point and make it any easier other than advising you that the IRS has issued guidance on these safe harbors, and that's available at their website, and it's titled Notice 2012-58. There's also guidance on the 90-day waiting period that I discussed earlier, which is 2012-59, and that will allow you to see it in black and white in full text. But for now, the best we can do is outline these complicated mathematical equations and answer any questions that you may have at the end of the presentation. With that said, I'm going to turn it back over to Laura, who will talk about the penalties should you not provide the minimal value and affordable coverage that we discussed previously.
Thanks, Courtney. The way that these penalties are triggered is when you have a full-time employee that uses a federal subsidy to purchase coverage on the exchange, what we think is going to happen is the exchange is going to be the reporting entity. It wasn't really a topic for discussion today, but these exchanges, you've heard about it, it's been in the news. Every state was supposed to create an exchange, and if they didn't, the federal government was going to do it for them, and the idea is that the exchange is a place where individuals can go to purchase health care coverage if they can't afford it or it's not offered through their employer. But when the employees go to these exchanges, the exchanges are going to get down all the information of where they work, how many, hours they work, who the employer is, what they offer in terms of health care coverage, what the cost of it is, they're going to be the reporting entity to the IRS. And so that's what's going to trigger the penalties for employers when the IRS follows up and realizes you have employees purchasing on the exchange. An applicable large employer generally will be liable for an employer shared responsibility payment only if the employer does not offer health coverage or offers coverage to less than 95% of its full-time employees and at least one full-time employee receives a premium tax credit to help pay for coverage on an exchange. Or, next slide, please, Steph, if the employer offers health coverage to at least 95% of its full-time employees, but at least one full-time employee receives a premium tax credit to help pay for coverage on an exchange, which may occur because either the employer did not offer coverage to that employee or because coverage the employer offered that employee was either unaffordable to the employee or did not provide minimum value. So, again, it's going to be employees going to the exchange that could trigger the penalties. Next slide, please, Steph. If an employer doesn't offer health coverage or offers coverage to less than 95% of its full-time employees, it violates Section 4980HA. An employer who violates that section would owe a shared responsibility payment equal to the number of full-time employees, not the full-time equivalent, just the full-time employees that the employer employed for the year multiplied by $2,000. So you take, you're over 50, so you're a covered employer, a large employer. If there's a violation in that you've got employees buying on the exchange and you don't meet any of the safe harbor provisions, the IRS would look at the number of full-time employees you have. So it would take out the full-time equivalent. So you could be down to, say, 35 employees. You would be subject to a penalty of $2,000 per employee, but you get the first 30 employees as a freebie. They take out the first 30 employees, full-time employees, and then they charge you $2,000 in penalties for each employee over 30. So in my scenario, if you have 35 full-time employees, you would only be assessed a penalty on 5 of them, and your yearly total, your annual penalty would be $10,000. The $2,000 penalty comes out to approximately $167 a month per employee. If, next slide, please, Steph. If the employer offers health coverage to at least 95% of its full-time employees, but still is required to make the shared responsibility payment due to coverage not being available to specific employees, it's unaffordable, or fails to meet the minimum value, that's a violation under Section B. And the penalty for offering unaffordable coverage is $3,000 for each full-time equivalent employee who's eligible for a premium tax credit subsidy and actually enrolls in an exchange plan. That comes out to about $250 a month per employee that you're penalized for. And for each Section B violation, the $3,000 violation, the employer would owe the shared responsibility payment computed separately for each month. So $250 a month, you have to do the calculations every month. If the monthly payment the monthly payment equals the number of full-time employees who receive a premium tax credit for that month multiplied by 1/12 of $3,000, which is the $250. Payment for a Section B violation is capped to ensure it does not exceed the penalty for failing to provide coverage. So, in other words, the maximum amount that is owed if you combine the $2,000 penalty and the $3,000 fines that the employer could be subject to is the maximum amount the employer would owe under the $2,000 penalty provisions. You calculate the maximum that you would owe under Section A violations, and I think that you calculate that, subtract what you are actually paying, and again, I'm not a tax person, I should have qualified this up front, subtract what you're paying under that penalty provision versus what your total could be, and then whatever's left over can be assessed under Section B violations, but you have a cap, and so it's less than it looks like on its face, but it still could be pretty burdensome depending on your situation. If an applicable large employer is found to be in violation, the IRS will contact you to provide an opportunity to respond before they assess liability. Again, they're going to get their information from the exchanges and from the individuals who are taking the tax credit. They're going to wait until after individual tax returns are due before they contact you. If they determine that you as a large employer are liable, they'll send you a notice and a demand for payment. So you don't have a reporting responsibility at this point in time on the penalties. Applicable large employers will not be required to include a shared responsibility payment on any tax return filed. And finally, which is true of any federal law or state law, employers can't retaliate against employees who receive the tax credit that lead the IRS to your doorstep to collect the penalty. So you can't retaliate against your employees if they opt to go to the exchange, and that triggers the IRS focusing on your company and coming to collect the shared responsibility penalties. That wraps up the information that Courtney and I wanted to present to you today. So now if anybody has any questions, we will do our very best to answer them.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so now by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you are using a speakerphone, we do ask that you pick up your handset or depress your mute function to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 at this time, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow you the chance to signal.
Okay, and I will field, this is Courtney, I will field a couple of these questions related to the rehire of employees and calculating whether they're full-time employees if they're a rehire. We do have a couple of examples about that. Here's an example for you. The employer hires a new seasonal employee on March 1st of 2014. That employee works 1,600 hours before being terminated on November 30th of 2014. The employee is rehired in April 2015, again as a seasonal employee. How will that employee be treated? This is what we believe to be true. When the employee was first there from the initial period of March through November, the employee worked at least 30 hours per week, actually averaged 30.7 as calculated by 1,600 divided by 52. The employee cannot be treated as a new seasonal employee upon the rehire because fewer than 26 weeks elapsed between her termination of employment and rehire. And because the alternative rule for rehire does not apply, the employee had worked about 39 weeks but was only gone for 17 weeks. If the employer could treat the employee as new, the employer could ignore the employee's prior 1,600 hours of service and impose a new initial measurement period upon the employee. So the employee is treated as full-time upon her return due to averaging at least 30 hours per week during the initial measurement period. It's not completely clear when the employer must offer coverage, but presumably it would be May 1st of 2015 because the employee's stability period would have originally started then if the employee had not terminated the employment in the first place. So the employee is treated as a full-time even through the end of the stability period. That was, in fact, when the employee is rehired. So there's some issues going on here, but in general, if you have somebody that you're rehiring, the calculation, you would apply the initial measurement period to the time when they were employed previously. If they calculate as a full-time employee, then when they're hired back, you cannot redesignate them or change that classification. You cannot ignore the prior hours of services. So that's an important thing to keep in mind as far as rehired. Again, this is sort of a murky area, but I hope that answers some of your questions when dealing with these seasonal variable employees. And in that example, the employer used a 12-month initial measurement period that began on the start of the employee's work day.
So, Courtney, let me ask you this. This is Stephanie. Tina Brandau had asked, with new hires that are variable staff, can the stability period be consistent to one starting January 1st through December 31st, regardless of what month they may have been hired in the year prior?
So we're dealing with the stability. So the stability period starts when the stability period is going to start when the measurement period ends, right? So if you have a new hire that's a variable staff, then you get to choose the initial measurement period. So assuming that you choose an initial measurement period of 12 months, then your stability period could be consistent 1-1 through 12-31. That's 12 months, or I guess it would be through 1-1. You got to keep in mind that with the stability period, it's got to be the same as the measurement period that you used. So as long as you're staying consistent or keeping at the baseline of 6 months, you'll be all right if you have a lower measurement period. But you can't go less than your measurement period.
We have another question from Adrian. Either Laura or Courtney, if you could answer, could you please discuss the measurement period requirements for rehires or variable employees with breaks in service? I'm not sure if your previous example may have given that answer already.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about with the breaks in service. The measurement period is typically going to apply to once they got hired in the first time and not to when they're rehired, because you could just presumably keep reclassifying the employee as new and starting a new initial measurement period, which could get you into some trouble. One thing that you may apply is a rule of parity, which is for a break that's less than 26 weeks. Under a rule of parity, an employee may be treated as a new employee if the employee's period of time with no credited hours of service is at least 4 weeks long and is longer than the employee's immediately preceding period of employment. So the rule of parity might be something that is probably applicable to your questions. Again, the rule of parity is only for a break that's less than 26 weeks, and that allows you to treat an employee as new only if the period of time that the employee was working, the employee's period of time with no credited hours of service, so the break time, is at least 4 weeks long and is longer than the time that the employee was working previously. So I would write that down, rule of parity, and keep that in mind. Another way that you can get around the general rule that if you had somebody working, they took a break, they come back, you can't reclassify them, is if the person had no hours of service for at least 26 consecutive weeks. So the number 26 is important for the rule of parity and for that classification. So if the break with zero hours of service is at least 26 consecutive weeks, you may be able to treat the rehired employee as a new employee.
Right now, I'm going to see if we have any phone questions.
We do have a phone question from Adrienne Russell with Turner Broadcasting.
You answered my question already. I had already submitted it online. Thank you.
Oh, excellent.
There are no further questions in the phone queue at this time, but again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one to ask a question.
We actually do have additional questions. Tina Brandau again had asked, what is the status of Michigan doing the Medicaid expansion?
Laura, have you heard anything about that?
The exchange or the Medicaid expansion, they're two different things. I think the exchange status is still that the state is in the position to be able to give input to the feds. They didn't totally default to the federal exchange. As far as the Medicaid expansion, there's a lot of talk that it is going to pass, but with some very unusual restrictions on who can take advantage of it. And for example, the 4-year limit on collecting any type of welfare benefits, I think, including the Medicaid, and they don't know if that will be a viable, considered a viable expansion of Medicaid by the federal government, because they don't think that that's going to fly. It's a hot issue in the legislature right now, and if you have an opinion on it, you should contact your legislators, because it's front and center on their plates right now.
Okay, we have another 2 questions from Cheney Robinson. The question is, if you have an employee who is part-time working over 30 hours per week and the company offers the insurance and they decline, are there any penalties for such an action, and do the employees have to take the insurance that's offered?
If they're part-time, I don't think so.
But the question, Lauren, just to clarify, because I can read it here, it says if they're part-time working over 30 hours a week, so if they're a full-time equivalent under the Act.
Yeah, well, actually, they're a full-time employee under the Act. Yeah.
Right. So in that case, you have a full-time, and I've heard this question before, too, because I've had a client that says, you know, we're gonna offer our employees this coverage, but what if they decline it and say that their husband, they're being covered through their husband's employer, or they have coverage elsewhere, and then we find out they didn't, and will we be liable for the penalty? Do we have to have written confirmation? Have you dealt with that issue at all yet, Laura?
No.
Yeah, I haven't, but that is a popular question, and that's something that we will look into. I think that that's an interesting question, because it does seem like that's something that could happen, that somebody denies the coverage, the coverage that's offered by the employer per the Affordable Care Act, and then is left without coverage and liability falls on the employer, but the employer was relying on the representation of the employee. That's something that the IRS has not discussed as far as to my knowledge, but something that we will look into, and hopefully won't be an issue for employers when they rely on their employees' representations. And I see that there's another question about the whistleblower provisions of the Affordable Care Act and what they will actually include. The whistleblower portion of the Affordable Care Act has been discussed by regulations provided by OSHA, which is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. OSHA has provided some regs that protect an employee against retaliation by an employer for receiving a tax credit or subsidy to participate in a health insurance exchange that Laura was talking about earlier, or for reporting violations of the Affordable Care Act consumer protections. So, for example, the prohibition against somebody denying insurance due to a pre-existing condition. So that is codified at Section 1558. Of the ACA, and it prohibits both public and private sector employees from retaliating against an employee because he or she received a low-income subsidy or because he or she reported or refused to participate in potential violations of Title I of the Affordable Care Act, or because he or she testified, assisted, or otherwise participated in a proceeding concerning the violation. So 3 things: for receiving a tax credit, for reporting a violation of the Act, or for assisting, testifying in a proceeding concerning a violation. So it pretty closely mirrors Michigan's Whistleblowers Protection Act in the type of activities that are protected activities, in addition to the actual receipt of the tax credit is a protected activity. So, for example, if an employer does not provide the minimal necessary coverage, an employee receives the tax credit, and it thus becomes reported, and the employer retaliates against the employee, that is a form of retaliation that's covered by the applicable provision of the ACA, of the Affordable Care Act. So I hope that answers your question as far as that's concerned.
We have one last question. Has there been any new guidance on the automatic enrollment provision?
I have not seen anything specific with regard to that. Laura, have you seen anything?
No, I thought they were delayed.
Yeah, I've not seen anything come down. The most recent I've seen come down is about the safe harbors. The automatic enrollment, I've not seen since the initial notices were issued. I've not seen that change.
Do we by any chance have any more questions on the phone?
There are no further questions on the phone line at this time.
I would just like to leave everyone with the thought that you should be establishing your stability periods right now and doing your look back to figure out what is going to be most advantageous to you when 2014 rolls around and you have to have these figures. This is the time to be getting your figures in order.
I agree with Laura. This act is, as we discussed, convoluted and quite frankly confusing. So the best way to attack it is one bite at a time starting now, putting yourself in the best position to have all of your ducks in a row when January 2014 rolls around, which will be here before we know it. And I'd like to thank everybody for joining us on this call, and hopefully we were able to answer some of your questions and provide you with guidance about the Affordable Care Act and the pay or play provision going forward.
Thanks, everyone.
I would like to conclude today's program with a couple of additional notes. There, Courtney was kind enough to have given some URLs and web addresses, and I just wanted to let everybody know that we're going to include those URLs, the web addresses, on the firm's event page that is for the that advertises the pay or play webinar. So we will update that web page so you can find the links to the pages that she has discussed. And you will also be soon receiving an online survey regarding today's program. If you would, please take a moment to complete it because your feedback really does help us assess the effectiveness of our programs and plan for future webinars.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's call. Thank you for your participation and have a great day.